T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6.
E is equal MC squared, in which energy is
all spent for man.
The human genome is our shared inheritance. And it is sitting in the property.
Cracks and cracks.
Hi, I'm Bob McDonald. What do buffalo jumps, caribou herds, and superheroes all have in common? They're all the subjects of new Canadian books featured today on our annual holiday book show. First, we'll journey to the West and find out how Aboriginal people managed to convince thousands of bison to commit suicide at Head Smashed In Buffalo Jump. It's a dramatic story of cunning, courage, and danger. Then we'll travel north for a look at Canada's threatened caribou population and what it means for the future of our northern lands. And finally, a medical researcher in Victoria tells us what it would take for humans to develop Batman's super crime-fighting abilities. Holy page-turner, Robin. But first, imagining the jump. This is Quirks and Quarks. Imagine trying to kill a massive, bad-tempered, violent beast, which is running across a vast wilderness with half a ton of churning muscle inside it. And all you have are a few sticks, some rocks, and a bit of ingenuity. And you have to figure out how to kill enough of those beasts to feed, clothe, and house you and your family. Well, Jack Brink has spent much of his career imagining that and trying to reconstruct just how Aboriginal people managed to do it. For thousands of years, Native people in Western Canada and the U.S. made an excellent living by hunting bison. And their best trick was devising a way to have the bison do much of the dirty work for them. At sites like Canada's famous Head Smashed In Buffalo Jump, huge numbers of bison would be carefully guided to a gory mass suicide. Just how this could have worked has been one of the central questions of Jack Brink's research, and he describes his discoveries in his new book, Imagining Head Smashed In: Aboriginal Buffalo Hunting on the Northern Plains. Jack Brink is the curator of archaeology at the Royal Alberta Museum in Edmonton. Mr. Brink, welcome to Quirks and Quarks.
Thank you, Bob. It's great to be here.
One of the many things that surprised me about your book is how you dispelled the myth that Native people hunted buffalo on horseback with rifles, which I think is how most of us think of them. But it wasn't really like that for most of history, was it?
No, that image is, I think, fixed in many people's minds, and it's pretty much courtesy of all the movies and television shows we've seen that feature horse-mounted Aboriginal warriors and hunters. But really, that was a very short blip in their entire lifespan on the northern plains. That lasted for about 200 years. But for at least 11, 12,000 years before that, Native people were here and they were on foot. And so they had to hunt animals like bison on foot. And you can imagine what a chore that would have been back in those days.
Well, how important were buffalo jumps in Native hunting?
Well, they were very important, but they were just one type of a mass type of kill. We call them communal kills, meaning that a great number of people had to come together, often numbering hundreds of people, to make these kills work. The buffalo jump was one method. There were buffalo pounds where they drove them into corrals. They drove them into rivers. They herded them into deep snow banks. They had an amazing number of tricks up their sleeve, which you can, you know, the more you think about it, the more you realize, of course they would. Why would they not, having spent 12,000 years living next to these animals and learning everything about their behavior?
Now, I think we should define here just what a buffalo jump is, because a funny thing happened to me on my way in today. I had your book in my hand, and somebody on the streetcar said, "That's an interesting title, Head Smashed In." But what's all that about? And I said, no, this is an actual place where they drove buffalo over a cliff. So just set the scene for me here. What actually is a buffalo jump?
Well, a buffalo jump is, by definition, a steep drop. It's usually a rocky cliff, but not always. It can be the bank of a river or a steep coulee edge. It's a steep drop which has behind it a landform that is suitable for rounding up and moving these large herds of buffalo towards this precipice and actually get them to go over it of their more or less own accord. They're obviously not stupid animals. They don't run over willingly, but the people had enough tricks up their sleeve that they made these things happen.
Wow. And how high is the cliff?
The one at Head Smashed In is about 10 meters. There are some that are a little bit higher. There are many that are about that size or a little bit lower. There are hundreds of buffalo jumps across the Western Plains. Some of them have been carefully studied. Many of them have not been. They're just simply there, and we know of them. But undoubtedly, there's many others we still haven't found yet.
And you describe in the book how these jumps were the largest sort of food-gathering events in human history.
That's one of those things that only occurred to me when I started writing the book. The amount of biomass at the bottom of a cliff at the end of one of these things would just be staggering. And I started pushing, you know, buttons on my little calculator and thinking, okay, an animal weighs this much, and if they had this many of them and so many males and females and probably some calves, and what would that all come to? And I came up with figures like 50, 60,000 kilograms. Even the hunting of bowhead whales by Inuit people would not have equaled the mass of a bison kill.
Wow. Now, you did mention that these people didn't have horses, they didn't have guns, they're on foot, and buffalo are not stupid. So what were some of the problems that they faced trying to get these animals over that cliff face?
Well, the biggest single problem they would face is that bison are smart. They've adapted to life on the plains for over millions of years. The advantages would all be in their favor on an average day. Out on the prairies, grazing with their tremendous sense of smell, being able to smell humans from kilometers away. Relatively decent eyesight, not keen eyesight, but not bad. And amazing speed, you know, capable of running 50, 60 kilometers an hour and sustaining that for long periods of time. So you can imagine hunters on foot, armed with either spears, bows and arrows, or similar types of weapons that are really only good at very close range, trying to move up and get close to these animals to kill one, they have very little going in their favor. So everything about buffalo hunting involves some kind of a trick, some kind of a trap, a manipulation where they flip those tables around and they gave themselves an advantage, knowing their reaction to things like the sense of smell, knowing how to manipulate the wind. So at times they actually let scent into the wind on purpose so the bison would smell it, to use that in their favor. Other times they use the wind to hide smells from them, knowing how they would run, knowing which leaders would lead the herd.
Now, how many people would be involved in a hunt towards a buffalo jump?
Well, we can only really guess. The best guess is, I think, several hundred as kind of a basic minimum. 10 or 20 or 40 would just not do it, but a couple hundred, because not only do you have the kill site itself, where you need many people down below to help dispatch the animals and, of course, to butcher and process them, that huge mass that you've just produced. But before you actually get to the jump itself, what in many cases we call a gathering basin, where you round these animals up and you start moving them towards the jump, and you need a great number of people out in that area to simply steer and manipulate the herds, keep them going in the desired directions. And we think, you know, probably a couple hundred was a basic working number for these things. And they would come together most often, we think, in the fall for these great hunt events, and then produce this enormous amount of food. And as you can appreciate, one of the prime purposes of this was to put away a great store of food and supplies that you would need then throughout the winter months, where going out and finding new herds and conducting these kinds of mass kills would become extremely difficult on the northern plains.
Well, that was one thing that came through in your book, is that this thing is, I mean, the image that you get when you see these diagrams are sort of the last second where the animals are thundering over the cliff. But actually, it took a long time before that, while they kind of quietly maneuvered the herd towards the precipice. That took a long time, and they were very slow about that.
Yeah, that's right. I think you're right. The image is of this great thundering mass of brown fur literally stampeding towards the cliff and then plunging with this, earth-wrenching plunge to the ground. And, of course, all that's true, and it would have been an incredible moment to be there and to actually see and witness that. There were probably at least a day, sometimes many days, of operations by a whole group of people that had various jobs to do, who had to go out, find these animals, start to gently coerce them into the desired direction, not wanting to stampede them, not wanting to get them scared or running, because that could ruin everything. You had to work for often many days to get them into the proper position for the final drive to the cliff, which itself could be just a matter of minutes, but you might have spent days leading up to that final dramatic moment.
What were the biggest surprises for you as you puzzled out how all of this was done?
I think the biggest surprise was the extent to which Native people had mastered certain aspects of, say, understanding buffalo behavior, and then using that to their advantage. And one of the things I think I found most compelling was reading about their use of disguises. They would drape hides over their own body of wolves, coyotes, deer, antelope, and of course buffalo calves was one of their favorite ones. And one of my all-time favorite quotes from the historic literature was an early explorer in Western Canada who saw a couple of buffalo runners, as they were called. This was the name given to these young men whose job it was to go out and round up the herds. He saw them put on some buffalo calf skins and then get down on all fours and crawl across the prairie, perfectly mimicking the sway of a calf, the antics, the head movements, the bobbing up and down, and then the bleating sound of a calf when it's separated from its mother, because that was the trick they used to actually pull these herds towards themselves, was bleat like a lost calf. And this explorer wrote in his journal, he said, so perfectly did these people imitate a lost calf that had I not seen them put on the disguise, I would have shot them thinking they were real animals. And then I was even more sort of thunderstruck by a subsequent version of it, where I read not only did they put on the bison calf outfits and mingle near the herd, but then other Aboriginal people would put on the skins of wolves and pretend to attack those calves. So they're faking an attack on fake calves so that the herd will come in defense of these calves. And all the time, of course, they're doing this, these people in disguise, both the calves and the people disguised as wolves, would be moving their way slowly towards the buffalo jump. And the whole idea is gently pull this herd in that direction. So not only did they use the calves, but they faked attacks by fake wolves on those. And you just shake your head and say, man, it's just an amazing story.
Now, not only that, but they had, in effect, a roadmap leading to the cliff in stones along the ground. And things like, tell me about how that was astounding.
Yeah, I think that was another thing that was not very well understood and studied at the time I began my work at Head Smashed In. These are what we call the drive lane cairns. And these are literally long, long lines of rock piles, very small piles, often 50, 60 centimeters in diameter and now only 10 or 20 centimeters high. Very innocuous, but there are thousands of them. At Head Smashed In, we've counted 8,000 or 9,000 of these rock lines, and they stretch for 8 or 9 kilometers back from the actual cliff. Now, it's not just a simple line. There's actually many converging lines. There's V-shape wedges of these lines that act as funnels. There's lines that cross over. It's a very complex system. But the net effect of it is to forming a sort of funnel of these long lines of rocks that converges at the actual precipice. And that got me to thinking about how they actually worked, and I came up with some theories that it wasn't actually the rock piles so much as it what they added to them, which was things of brush and buffalo dung, chips piled up. And what they're doing is making them bigger, more substantial, and something that maybe moves or sways in the wind. Because one thing we know about bison, and clearly Aboriginal hunters did too, is that they're very sensitive to motion. Any sense of motion in their environment, it catches their eye and it gets their attention, and they don't particularly like it because it could be something bad. So they made these drive lanes with a sense of motion, and by doing so, they could actually not have to man them all the way along. They could have them essentially stand in for the place of human beings. In fact, some of the early explorers actually referred to them as dead men in their journals. And I think that's a bit of a clue. They're saying these things functioned as human beings.
They're like scarecrows.
Yeah, and that word was used in the literature as well. You see that appear.
Okay. So they've gone through all these tricks of disguise, of slowly maneuvering the herd, having these roadways that lead to the precipice. Here we are, the day of. What happens at that final moment when they finally get those buffalo to leap over that cliff edge?
If I could go back in time just once, I'd like to stand at the edge of a buffalo jump. Not too close, but a little ways away, and just watch that, because just try and imagine, close your eyes for a minute and think what it would be like to have a line of hunters armed with nothing except probably holding a buffalo robe, because that acts as a visible barrier for the animals, forming this V-shaped funnel leading up to the cliff edge, and right between that funnel, coming at about 50 kilometers an hour, is a herd of maybe 100, 150 of the largest land mammal in North America. You would literally feel it coming up through the bones of your legs. Many Europeans talk about being able to feel the buffalo herds from as much as a mile or two away and feel the earth shake. Well, imagine being within a couple meters of this and having this train of brown biomass thundering past you, and then that moment where they hit the air and they just sail because they don't see the jump till the very final moment, and when the leaders do see it, it's too late for them to stop. They might try to break, they might try to turn to the side, but the key, one of the key elements to a buffalo jump is you've got this huge biomass running right behind you at full speed because they are a herd animal, a gregarious animal, and this mass running behind you is going to literally push the leaders right over the cliff. And so if everything went right and everything was aligned up with the spirit world that day, these animals would go sailing over the cliff, and they would keep sailing over right till the very last one went over. And you can imagine, picture yourself standing within a meter or two of this, holding a buffalo robe, waving and shouting, and just hoping that everything went right. Because if they turned and came towards you, you'd be dead, and there's nothing you could do to stop it.
Boy. Well, after all of this, I'm just trying to imagine the carnage. I can't imagine that many dead animals all piled on top of one another, or not dead, just the wounded ones and the noise. And I mean, it must have been, I mean, from an animal point of view, not a nice day. But how did they deal with this huge mass of animals at the bottom of the cliff after the jump was over?
Yeah, that would have been a staggering proposition, almost as daunting as the idea of rounding them up in the first place and getting them to that point. To look when at the aftermath, to just gaze up at that slope and see this huge pile of brown biomass fur, some of it still moving and quivering, and realizing you now have to process that. You have to deal with that in a very systematic and orderly way, because the whole point of this thing is to walk away with literally tons and tons of meat that you'll be able to use for not just days, even weeks, but for months to come. Otherwise, all that work is wasted. The real key element now for people was to take this pile apart and to process it in a way that maximized the amount of meat and fat and hide and bone that they could preserve for long periods of time and use for many months to come.
So when was the last time that buffalo went over the head-smashed-in buffalo jump?
Well, we don't know the exact date. The archaeological records and historic records are not that fine to give us that level of detail. But my best guess is sometime in the middle of the 1800s, maybe 1830 to 1850, all of this came to an end.
Mr. Brink, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob. It's been great.
Jack Brink is the curator of archaeology at the Royal Alberta Museum in Edmonton. His new book, Imagining Head Smashed In, is published by the University of Athabasca Press. A free electronic version of the book is available on the press website, and you can get to that from a link on our own website.